Open Source RVA. I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. More than 24 people spoke up Thursday at the latest public hearing of the state's new regulations that subject state abortion clinics to stringent new construction standards. The Board of Health held the public hearing with another set for this upcoming Tuesday in Alexandria. Among the speakers was former Virginia Health Commissioner Karen Remley, who resigned from the board in October. At the time of her resignation, Remley informed the governor that she could no longer head the department in good faith, citing strong arm tactics and other alleged political maneuvering. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports that at the hearing, Remley urged the board and other health department officials to avoid overreaching interpretations and advised that for all healthcare facilities, including abortion facilities, rigidity and interpretation could decrease access to safe and quality care. The final vote for regulations is set later in the year, but the 60-day public comment period lasts until March 29th, so concerned citizens still have a few weeks to make their voices heard on the Virginia Regulatory Town Hall website, townhall.virginia.gov. Virginia history buffs have two upcoming events to mark on their calendars. Both are programs exploring Gabriel's Conspiracy, the thwarted insurrectionary plot of 1800 planned by the literate enslaved blacksmith Gabriel and other enslaved Africans, which would have included a march through Richmond. On Wednesday, March 13th at noon, the Library of Virginia will host Pinning Gabriel's Rebellion. Historians Greg Kimball, Michael Nichols, and Phil Schwartz will use the interactive website HistoryPin to trace the activities and events leading up to the best-planned Virginian slave rebellion. According to the library, their own documents and the region's geography will merge to make a picture of the actions and aftermath of the legendary Henrico bondsman. Later that same day, Wednesday the 13th at 7 p.m., Drs. Nichols and Schwartz, who have both written books about Gabriel's conspiracy, will discuss this landmark in Virginia history. The talk will be held at VCU Singleton Center for the Performing Arts. Details for each of these March 13th history happenings can be found at the Library of Virginia website, lva.virginia.gov, and the VCU Library's website, library.vcu.edu/events/Gabriel. Both events are free and open to the public, but registration is required for the VCU event. Monday the 11th marks 2 years since the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami in Japan and the ensuing ongoing nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The Coalition Against Nukes and Nuclear-Free Virginia Richmond chapter will be hosting a rally against nuclear power at the Dominion Virginia Power Building from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Monday. Via press release, the organizers announced their intent to raise awareness of the dangers of nuclear energy and to encourage Dominion to invest in safer renewable energy sources to replace its aging nuclear reactors, as well as to stand in solidarity with the Japanese people and victims of the crisis.
Have you heard about the painter Vincent van Gogh, who loved color and who let it show? Now in the museum, what have we here? The baddest painter since Gauguin Vermeer. And he loved life so bad, his paintings had twice the color other painters had. So bad that the world had to know. The man loved color and he let it show.
It's the million-dollar question, according to Anthony Harris. What's the deal with public art funding in Richmond? Harris, the publisher of RVA Magazine and one of the spearheads behind last year's G40 Art Summit and the upcoming Richmond Mural Project, posted an online article this past week that asked some pointed questions about how money is allocated for public art in Richmond, who gets it, and why the rules that tie all public arts funds to new capital projects seems to limit the kind of public art found in the city. Ed Trask is a prominent local artist, musician, and activist. He's been twice voted as Richmond's best artist by Style Weekly readers. And he was also one of the organizers behind 2012 Street Art Festival. He, too, has some questions about how we allocate art funds in the city. Anthony Harris and Ed Trask join us today on Open Source RVA for the first in a two-part series on Richmond public art funding. We plan to have a representative from Richmond's Public Art Commission join us on a future broadcast. So, Tony, your article in RVA Magazine that was posted, that you say the million-dollar question is, what's up with our public art? What are your concerns?
My main concern is, and in going through the process of trying to get public art funded, mm-hmm. get public art projects funded, mm-hmm. you know, through my own personal stuff, and then having worked with other organizations like First Friday and seeing how they struggle to get the money they need just to operate. You know, I'm not really clear on how the city, you know, goes about figuring out what they're going to spend on art and the correct way to go about it. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's a very kind of hit or miss system, and you're always kind of begging for the money. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you can look over to the Public Arts Commission, and it's funded pretty well. Mm-hmm. Now, my question is there a way to submit a proposal or, you know, work with that money to help these annual mm-hmm. art projects be funded? And that was kind of the thrust of it. You know, there's $1.3 million allotted in 2011 with additional projects that have been made. There's been additional money allotted. It's close to $3 million there. But there's nobody you can talk to,
yeah.
and no one wants to talk about it.
Right.
You know, and I'm not sure why.
Well, it seems like the public art funds that are available now are tied into capital projects, where a certain amount of money, I believe, is $250,000. Anything over $250,000 will get some sort of either 1% or another figure of money.
Right.
So is that the problem, the fact that we only look at public art as something that can go up with a new building?
I mean, that's part of the problem. I think that's, it feels like it's a pittance. You know, I feel like the city has had mm-hmm. to put that money aside to kind of placate the art community.
Right.
You know, and now art is a major marketing piece for the city, mm-hmm. you know, not only in the region but nationally. Now, how do you put a price on, you know, how much First Fridays generates for the city? Mm-hmm. You know, what has it done to improve community relations?
Yeah.
What has it done to even make a brand? Mm-hmm. You know, is there a dollar amount? If you could figure that out, it would be, you know, it would be very mm-hmm. clear that it's underfunded,
mm-hmm.
you know, and has always been. Other projects like the RVA Street Art Festival,
mm-hmm.
A project that I worked on last year, which is the G40 mural project and the Richmond mural project this year, it's hard to quantify exactly what that brings into the city, but I think if you use common sense, you can kind of look and people that have lived here for 10 years can see
yeah.
that these things have improved, and they've improved from grassroots, and they've always been underfunded. So,
especially when you consider the millions of dollars spent on huge projects that don't produce the results intended,
right.
And then you have these grassroots initiatives that do work, you'd think there'd be a way to reward those things.
You would think the city could find a way to make it easier
mm-hmm.
To where these organizations don't have to essentially 6 months before the project beg for money.
Right.
You know, and I know that, especially First Fridays, I know that every year they're going to bat trying to find somebody to help them mm-hmm. raise dollar amounts that are not that huge. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're asking the same corporations. Now, the frustrating part for me and the reason why I wrote that article was looking across and being like, wow, there is funding for art, and it's sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
And not discrediting or talking in any negative way about the Public Arts Commission. They've done a lot of great work. But I think they're put in a tough spot right now where they're more well-funded than any other arts organization that I can think of outside of the VMFA. And I don't know if VCU gets funded by the state. I guess it does. But and yet be sitting on the other side being like, well, all I need is $10,000.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
You know, and there's $3 million sitting there. It's like, well, how do we have a conversation with the PAC and the city and figure out, well, that money has already been allotted by law, so they're on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get them to either the PAC creates another program that uses some of that funds, or is there a way to change the verbiage
mm-hmm.
and get it being, you know, it's so narrow right now that you have to use this money for these narrow projects.
Mm-hmm.
Can we just add another sentence or two to the project and expand it out to
right.
fund annual projects that have been successful and that need money and they have a benefit to the city?
Ed, when you and John Belisles were putting together the street art festival that happened last year, did you receive any city money, or did you try to get any money from the city?
Yeah, we did receive some city money.
Oh, okay, but it didn't come from the PAC, the Public Art Commission.
No, it did not. It did not. We didn't even approach the PAC with the program to begin with. Mm-hmm. And the good thing about going to corporate funding and we weren't really depending on the city. Mm-hmm. Which I don't think G40 wasn't either. I mean, it was something that was being brought about in the hopes that people would kind of come to it once mm-hmm. they saw the impact it was going to have. But I tell you, you know, it's a lot of what Tony's bringing up is a great question. I think it would have been easier if there would have been a new style of being able, or something to be able to approach the PAC. Like right now, I think it's almost like an antiquated way of procurement. You know, they'll send out RFPs and it goes through a board, and you have months and months of waiting, and then you get the cheapest kind of cheapest bid for art. But if there was a way to submit proposals, if there was, mm-hmm. and I think it means that you have to kind of reinvent.
You mean that aren't tied to capital projects?
Exactly. And so if you could reinvent that and give it a little bit of a shift, I think it would work. But I know that's really, really hard work. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a figure here that Richmond has spent $889,104 on 39 public art projects since 1993. That doesn't seem like a lot of money to me. When you consider that.
Since 93? That's 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a lot at all. Well, you also look at the fact that we're a city that's not just standing on its laurels of being a historically known city. Mm-hmm. We're seeing companies of, you know, beautifully innovative companies. We're seeing these creative hubs. We have a new VCU's new
contemporary art
is going to put Richmond on the map. We have so many amazing things happening that the momentum, it's incredible how fast it's moving. And now at this point, I think with technology and with the way the information rolls around, it's got to change a little bit on how we mm-hmm. put the money, how the money is given to different organizations that could really use it.
Well, especially considering that Mayor Jones is on record. In fact, I interviewed him about this time last year, and that was the first thing that he brought up when I talked about the arts was public art. In fact, his quote was, "I think when you go to larger cities, or not even larger cities, but cities that are sensitive to the need of artistic display, you just see a lot of public art. We visited Norfolk not long ago, and we visited some public housing, and they had art in that. I remember commenting on a piece of art that was there in the entrance. It's a very prime component, and I think that if the city is going to thrive, we have to have that dimension."
Well,
now, you would think coming along with that maybe would be a new way of funding public art. With that attitude.
Yeah, and I think on that point, there needs to be a new way of also showing a rate of return. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that a lot of the times a city might think of art as a welfare program or some kind of like thing that they have to do, mm-hmm. a civic duty, when, you know, if the money was allotted, it was transparent to the community, if there was a way to submit projects, there was a streamlined way of approval, mm-hmm. and at the end of the year, somebody wrote a report and said we spent X amount of dollars, and for every dollar we spent, this is what we thought we got in return. You know, whether that be tax dollars or whether that be press that was written about these mm-hmm. projects, mm-hmm. and then I would think that would kind of change their perspective on it. You know, instead of it being something that they have to do to appease us artists, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. and I use that as a kind of maybe the way they think about us, but yeah. You know, it's kind of, but it's an actual good business decision that makes sense for the city to mm-hmm. fund.
Well, they certainly use the local art scene as a selling point.
It's
sure,
everything.
Sure, oh, yeah.
So it would only make sense that you would want to help that.
Well, but with a university that's you know, internationally known, you mm-hmm. know, and we have a lot of art stars. We have, you know, the MacArthur Genius Grant has gone to what, 5 people from VCU. I mean, it's definitely becoming internationally known. But I mean, in a time where we're seeing serious budget cuts to schools and to major cities, the fact that, you know, Sal Ann Bowring and some of the people that have really fought to keep the PAC there, mm-hmm. we're very lucky to have it. You know, so the last thing I think Tony and I would ever want to do is to be for people to think that we're coming against the PAC. We're not at all. We're just trying to find maybe, you know, a, a more transparent sensibility, so the public can see what it's like, and maybe just really shake up and change the procurement process a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that really great things are starting to happen in the city of Richmond, but they're happening fast, mm-hmm. and they don't have the time to sit around and wait for a 6 month or a year long procurement process. We need to find a way to get funding, and the public needs to find a way to know what's really happening with the money and mm-hmm. really what the PAC does, because a lot of people just don't know what it is.
Well, yeah. Bruce Tyler, the former council person last year, proposed limiting the already existing funds for public art. And I actually thought that this would have been a really good time to have a dialogue
about
public art, but it didn't seem to happen. Even though for a bit there, people actually were, public art,
Well, I think that specifically is what pushed me to write the article. Because mm-hmm. I was looking at it and going, and I reached out to Sally, and she seemed very frustrated by the situation. There was an article in the Times-Dispatch last year talking about that situation of taking the funding down to $250,000.
Right.
And it's like, well, here's a few million dollars that's in the pot, and they want to bring it down. Why? Mm-hmm.
I think his problem was he didn't want a big, huge art project put in that jail.
Right. Yeah. Again, it's that narrow definition of what they are supposed to mm-hmm. do.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that schools are exempt. Like, when there's a new school, you don't have to. So all school construction projects, they don't have to have the art component.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, it would be a terrible thing to have public art around public schools. That would be a horrible
thing. It would
be a
disaster, wouldn't it? What do we look for in public art? Are we looking for something to inspire? Are we looking for something that will highlight the local art scene? What exactly is public art, or what should it be?
That's a
broad
question.
Yeah.
Right. I think, if anything, if you have public art that's being funded by cities, or you have public art being funded by larger corporations, basically I believe that what that does is it creates the tools. It puts the tools out in the public for communities to be able to grab hold of that and create a new optimistic sensibility about their environment. Mm-hmm. It bridges a gap between government, corporation, and community. It also brings about a sensibility of revitalization. But the thing that's most important, I think, for public art is that it takes the common person, shakes them up a bit, and lets them look at life in a new creative way. But it's not just that it's one person. It's an inclusive event that bridges the gaps between every socioeconomic balance and line. So you have every single person that can take in a piece of art, give it their interpretation, mm-hmm. and take it home with them any way they please. And that's important because every society has to have that to be a thriving society.
And I want to add to that a specific example. When we did we did murals all throughout the city, but we did one.
This was for the G40.
Yeah, last year. We did one on Hull Street, and it was the worst. It's a pretty rundown neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And we were on this giant wall, and Pixel Poncho from Italy was putting up this giant dragon, which out of place there, right? Mm-hmm. But he was there for 3 days, and I was there helping him for most of that time, watching him work. And neighborhood, people were coming out all the time and just stopping and seeing it and being like, what is this? Mm-hmm. And then being like, this is great. Little kids were seeing it on the way to school, and it gave people pause. It mm-hmm. gave them maybe something to talk about. It mm-hmm. made them feel positive about the community. And then the last night we were finishing up, I remember at dusk, it must have been a street gang. It was like 10 guys, and they were drinking 40s, and they were stopping and just talking with me about art. And I thought, wow, this is, this feels really very ridiculous, but at the same time, very positive, maybe they saw some value in it. Maybe they saw some value in their neighborhood.
Right.
And, maybe one of those guys, told their kids about it or something. You really can't put it into an equation, but I see nothing negative in promoting art that sits in the public space at
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you're bringing art to people, not expecting them to come to it, too.
That's exactly true. And a lot of what came up earlier is the sense that public art's not quantitative in its results. You know, the hope is that it takes people to a different enriched place that, you know, they need to go, they need to be. Mm-hmm. But we know it revitalizes. We know it brings about a different sensibility of economic development. We know it makes people see their environment completely differently. Mm-hmm. And for that, it's important. But we also know it helps kids learn differently. It helps. There's just so many positive attributes to public art, but at the same time, there's no way to appease everybody. So,
yeah.
Art being objectionable, everybody is going to have something bad to say about mm-hmm. a piece. You know, mm-hmm. everything from the Street Art Festival to G40. You know, you right. hear majority of things are positive, but you still there's plenty of people somebody that are negative
yeah,
against
yeah.
it, and
or someone who just doesn't think it's that there should be public art, that there should be. That right. their tax dollars should support this.
Well, and I think right. that's the danger of when somebody from the business side or from city government goes, what is public art? I'd like to be more involved, and I'd like to figure out a way to take that question and apply it and kind of translate it mm-hmm. into something that they understand. And that's
right.
crunching numbers, you know, and having some kind of business sense about it. You know, this money will be used for these projects. Mm-hmm. This is the return that we saw.
Right.
I think that needs to happen, and kind of hits on Ed's idea of there needs to be another way of procurement. There needs to be another way of figuring out the worth of it, you know, not in a you know abstract way, but in a dollars and cents ways, you mm-hmm. know, and that, and hopefully that would allow people to feel more comfortable about tax dollars being used mm-hmm. for projects like First Friday, Inlight, mural projects, or this or that,
right.
you know. I think that's crucial to the whole argument.
Let's do a little postmortem on the festivals that happened last year. Now, you're about to have, Tony, you're about to have the Richmond Mural Project.
Yes.
Which is that an offshoot of what happened last year? Explain a little bit about that.
It's a little bit of an evolution mm-hmm. of the G40 Mural Project. Last year was the first time that we had even attempted it. So this year, the G40... Or I guess going back to last year, the G40 mural project was actually two projects. The G40 was for the group show that was actually in the rented art spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mural project was the murals.
Yeah.
So this year the murals are coming back, and we're trying to do another 20 murals.
Mm-hmm.
And then the
G40
part.
Where will they be? All over the city?
Yeah, actually this is a little more spread out than last time. We're going to have a few on Broad Street. But there's going to be some in, I believe, Scott's Edition, three in the Main Street area.
Mm-hmm. And these will be local artists, regional artists, national artists?
These are an international.
Okay.
And then there is one or two local artists in the mix.
Okay, good.
So we have three guys from Poland, Edom Crew. Mm-hmm. We have Megs coming from Australia. We have Roa coming back from Belgium.
Oh, cool.
So it's a real Gaia from Baltimore. It's a whole eclectic crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Jesse Smith from Richmond. And a few others mm-hmm. that we're working with, you know, in talks with right now.
And this will be?
April 15th through the 29th.
Ed, looking back, the Street Art Festival was people were talking about that for a long time. What were your thoughts? What were the benefits? What were the pitfalls of going through that?
Well, I mean, I thought it was a great success. For me, it was great to have an event that brought about this inclusive thing where people could see art being made. You could see, you know, internationally known local artists. You could see local vendors, people that are making stuff with their hands. You could see this convergence. But I think we were very lucky that this convergence happened along, you know, when G40 was here, because it really
They happened around the same time, right?
They did, and it just took the
city. I thought y'all did that on purpose, but
well, no. You know, that's fine. They were separate, but at the same time, they weren't. I mean, it really affected the city in a very positive
mm-hmm.
way,
mm-hmm.
and I think it showed the possibilities of what could happen with public art and with street art. But I think one of the really neat things is, you know, we raised a lot of money for Art 180 for the Writers Guild. We raised awareness that certain areas in Richmond could become kind of like an outdoor gallery, become a place mm-hmm. to walk to. I mean, just going that area, I would ride back and forth, you know, to get to the trails.
I heard from people that was the first time that they had been down there.
Right.
That you had drawn them there to the
park. That's the hope.
To the flood wall.
Right. And you could bring, you know, I mean, there's got to be a connect between, you know, this amazing trail system, the gorgeous river we have, and the city and the fan and Churchill. And if you can bring all these people together, you can start seeing how beautiful that area was. That was kind of one of the reasons why we wanted to put art there. And art is that bridge that brings you to different places you would never go. And that's what I think public art is vital. And that is we revitalize that little area. We brought people there. I mean, there's constant traffic there. And that's the same thing with the murals from G40. You know, certain buildings that you would have taken for granted now get realized in a different light because you have a mural on there. And once again, people are interpreting that property not through the eyes of it being completely bombed out and covered in bad graffiti and falling apart. No, they actually make a different interpretation of what could this building be? What could it become? Mm-hmm. And how can we change this area? Mm-hmm. So it brings about that sense of optimism that's vital.
Well, will you do this again? Is it going to be a street art festival this year?
We're hoping to do it maybe September, November, December. We don't know. We haven't had any okays on some of the areas that we want yet. Mm-hmm. But fingers crossed, it'll happen again. It's not happening this April. And if we have to go back to the spot we had that we were talking about, we were going to do that every 2 years anyway down on the power plant. We'll see if the power plant doesn't sell. But hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll be late summer.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, guys, for coming in.
Thanks for
having
us. No
problem. Thank you, Don.
I'm Don Harrison, and we've been talking with artist Ed Trask, who helped to organize last year's Street Art Festival, and Anthony Harris of RVA Magazine and the Richmond Mural Project. Harris wrote a provocative piece this week on how Richmond allocates public arts funds. You can find that piece and more information on June's Richmond Mural Project at rvamag.com. And for more on the Street Art Festival, go to rvastreetart.com. And look for part two of this discussion about Richmond's public art funding on a future broadcast of Open Source RVA.
Gabby Schatzi, a WRIR sound engineer and co-producer of locally produced Open Source RVA. WRIR is the only radio station in Richmond who airs programs on LGBT issues. The Rainbow Minute and This Way Out have been on WRIR since the station first went on air in 2005. I want WRIR to continue, so that's why I donated and volunteered. You should too. Call 804-622-9747. Visit WIR at 1621 West Broad Street or donate online at WIR.org. I follow where my mind goes. Love my way, it's a new road. I follow where my mind
Tom Shields, he's a professor of educational leadership with University of Richmond School of Professional and Continuing Studies. Kim Bridges, former Richmond School Board Chairwoman, who's in Shields program and who is helping to organize this upcoming event. Jen Siegel-Hawley, I hope I've gotten that pronounced right, assistant professor at VCU in the School of Educational Leadership, and John Meeser, senior fellow at the Bonner Center for Civic Engagement and somebody who's been very civically engaged for a very long time. John, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about why, I guess, this kind of a community conversation is an important one to have? You certainly have a long history of observing Richmond public schools and, I guess, schools in general in the Richmond area and interaction in our community, right. I suppose.
Well, I'd say there are two fundamental factors that really led to the planning for this conference. One, and this will be discussed later by my colleagues, but one is that while we have segregated schools, yes, and we're seeing this segregation very much in the counties, that no longer is segregation of schools strictly characteristic of the city, not characteristic of the suburbs. There are suburbs that in their schools share the same demographics as schools in the city, and that presents some opportunity if we're willing to be serious about what the Brown decision really was all about. It's unfortunate that many people...
Brown v. Board.
That's right. It's the classic 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education decision. And incidentally, while I'm talking about that decision, that leads me to the second factor that gave rise to the conference. And that is that this is the 40th anniversary, 1973, is the 40th anniversary of another very important Supreme Court decision.
Maybe more so in the context of Virginia.
In many ways, yes, because it really brought to a halt what could have been. A region-wide school district. But in any event, in 1973, the United States Supreme Court upheld an appellate court decision. The appellate court then overturned a major federal district court decision. Judge Robert Marriage is the one who ordered the consolidation of three school districts into one school district, Richmond, Chesterfield, and Henrico. That decision was cataclysmic. It created immense white outmigration to the suburbs. And quite honestly, since that decision, we have been stalled. What's happened is the demographics have changed. People have moved, and we're now beginning to see poverty, intense poverty, move into the suburbs. And that now is being reflected in the schools. So that's what led me to say initially that now we see segregated schools in parts of Henrico and Chesterfield. And we certainly have segregated schools in the city, but we no longer can literally segregate the schools strictly on the basis of city-county. It is both city and county that share the same characteristics. That gives us the opportunity.
Now, Kim, you were on school board for a number of years, and in fact, you were in the top school elected school board position for, I guess, two terms, right, as the chairwoman.
Right.
Your job for all of your time on the school board was to work to, I guess, improve the system, but also, I guess, in some instances, sort of defend the system. You're now looking at it in a very critical way. How difficult is that to sort of, I guess, come at it from this other direction?
Well, actually, a good school board member's job is to look critically as much as they can while they're there. But here's the thing. I mean, I served on the Richmond School Board for 6 years, and in 6 years before that was a PTA leader, both at a local school level and citywide level. And one of the reasons I didn't run again for school board was I started really seeing the impact of some of these larger social issues that were well beyond the control of even the entire school board.
Yeah.
And that was really the precipitating reason for my becoming a part of this planning group was this was an exact issue that I had identified as a school board member where I thought, gosh, you know, if there were people working from the outside to support some of these concepts, we would be having an entirely different conversation on the school board about things like resources and equity and excellence.
Now, I have a feeling that some of those things that you were noticing probably play very much into some of what John was just talking about. But can you kind of, I guess, tell us what those things are, I suppose?
Well, I mean, the issue of school diversity is, to me, one of the preeminent issues impacting Richmond Public Schools. John talked about the history that led to that, and I came here in 98. I knew very little about that history. But what I saw from the ground up was not only this issue of segregated schools, but also the potential, the opportunity for some of the schools in the city to reverse that trend. And we're starting to see some of those some of those things taking hold at in places like Chimborazo Elementary, even a new initiative at Westover Hills Elementary, Holton Elementary, Hill Middle School, where my children went to middle school. You know, these are diverse city schools. And so one of the reasons I wanted to do something else after school board was to look at ways that that trend could increase and really impact equity and excellence for all kids in the city, as well as the counties. Again, you know, you get to be a school board member, you're just representing the city, but you're looking at county demographics, you're looking at what your county counterparts are going through too. And I started to realize, like John said, there are not so many differences anymore. The achievement gap is the achievement gap. And that happens in Henrico, Chesterfield, the exurbs as well.
Yeah, and it's funny, I have become way too aware, I guess, all too aware of, you know, I guess in covering Richmond Public Schools, there's sort of an assumption that, oh, this is the problem, school district in the area. But when you look more and more at Henrico, especially, and two at Chesterfield, Henrico has a lovely glaring example that's named after Henrico. Henrico High School is really probably in many ways the preeminent example of a segregated school in some ways. It draws from a general population that is sort of put in motion around public housing and low-income housing to the east. And then in order to sort of mask some of those numbers, they've got their the IB program and another special program that are in there, one other magnet school. And because of that, it ends up so inflated, it makes the U.S. News and World Report's best high schools in America list, in spite of the fact that it also has the highest dropout rate, the highest number of, I guess we'll call them fake diplomas, the diplomas that don't count outside of Virginia. I mean, that really is an incredibly powerful example of where the counties are starting to see, I guess, the exact same issues that the city has been sort of blamed for, or I guess has been stuck with for many years, or I guess saddled with, trying to combat that sort of social problems, I suppose. Right. Is that sort of what you're looking at with this, is that it's no longer just a city problem. This is our problem as a community.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is the same. It's a regional challenge, but also this time period means that there are regional opportunities. And, you know, I think you're citing one example of an effort that's gone on to try to bring some diversity to a school system. But what the conference is going to try to do is show some things that have happened in other areas as potential ideas for what Richmond might want to do, as well as talk about some of the initiatives underway here that could take greater hold if more folks were involved.
Can we talk a little bit about the conference itself and what you guys are planning to bring together and what sort of conversations you hope to generate with that? And I guess one of the two of you, Jen or Tom, who we've not heard from.
Yeah, we are bringing in practitioners and academics from across the United States, and it was purposely done that way. We wanted to, as an academic, and those of us that are, you know, are in the academy, we, you know, we could have just brought in academics and looked at the research and looked at what's happening in this field, and there is a lot starting to emerge here now as we see these demographic changes across the United States, and Jen will talk about some of her research that she's doing and with Gary Orfield and others. But
now you're looking more at the demographics, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And but we also decided to bring in practitioners across the United States where there's been best case examples on this, best practices, if you will, of what's happened and in other places, other regions, and to combine both of these. And so the day will actually start off with looking at, as John mentioned, some of the history here and why this history, this anniversary is so so important. And in some area, in some ways, if you talk to a lot of Richmonders, they don't know about this decision, which I think would have impacted, you know, immensely. It would have been, I think, a good setting stage for where we could be as a region if this had gone through. And so we're going to start with that history and look at that, and then get into more of a dialogue with what's going on currently. We're going to have a lunch panel of students, teachers, and principals, and a superintendent that will be moderating it to talk about, again, what's happening here locally. And then
which superintendent is going to be?
Dr. Jamel Wilson out of Hanover. Okay, we actually have two superintendents that are participating, and the other superintendents are having people engaged in this as well. And we are having a good representation from across the school system. Again, we wanted this to be an engaging process where, you know, people came to the universities and had thought about ideas, but also could see some of this in practice. So
now, Jen, before we get to the demographics, I'd like to, if we could, briefly go back to 1973. You can't put too much emphasis on the importance of 1973, that decision. Virginia is somewhat unique in that our city and county structure is very different than any place else in the country. They are separate. A city is separate from a county, is separate from a city. And never the twains do meet. And that case would have broken those walls down. It would have created a single consolidated district that would have potentially mitigated, or would have made it a lot more difficult to flee to the suburbs, so to speak, white flight, to flee to the suburbs. The thing that essentially led us to where we are today. But then some of that has continued, and I guess that's what the demographics are about. But John, how important was this 73 decision, I guess? Again, I'm saying it, but... and it had some local people involved too, right? Justice Powell?
Oh, yes. It was epic. And the response to that decision, I was here at the time, and I'll never forget it, was literally cataclysmic. And what I mean by that is that citizens were furious.
With marriage's decision.
That's right. And they were so furious that marriage's life itself was in danger. And U.S. Marshals surrounded his house. Oh, my, those were very, very difficult days. And the immediate response was that people with school-aged children living in the city, once the Supreme Court decision was made, pulled out. They moved immediately to the counties because the counties now were going to be unaffected as a result of the Supreme Court decision.
So it almost gave them a safe.
That's right.
As exactly. They would see safe a place haven. To go.
Right.
And so they went.
That's correct.
So what did the demographics, I'm assuming you're looking at today's demographics, what are they showing?
Well, you know, I think going back to the 73 decision for just a second, one of the motivations was that all of us, I think, realized that there were other places not that far away from here, Charlotte, Mecklenburg, Raleigh, Wake County, Louisville, Jefferson County, that did take a more regional city-suburban approach to school desegregation. And, you know, Louisville is a great example. Their school segregation levels are much lower than what we see in the Richmond area, and they also have experienced a much faster decline in housing segregation, because people know they can move to any part of the region and attend a high-quality integrated school.
Presumably, they still have their own deep-run high school, but the differences, the inequities are not quite as extreme? Or?
They do not, because not only do they have the city suburban school district, they have a student assignment policy that looks at the demographics of neighborhoods across the city suburban district and tries to make sure that each school has a mix of students from different kinds of neighborhoods. And the director of student assignment in Louisville, Jefferson County, is coming to the conference, and she's going to talk through how that policy works and some of the history there.
And it is equitable. I mean, presumably we haven't seen anything about how their busing is...
It has, the plan
these,
requires...
These things that are controversial, yeah, I guess.
The plan does require some transportation. They recently tweaked it. They've got all this new technology now that lets you use GIS maps to map out the shortest bus routes. But, you know, Gary Orfield and the Civil Rights Project did a study on the plan last year, I think, and it has really widespread community support. And it's faced its share of challenges.
But it's not so onerous an issue, this busing, that we hear about it in the news, where it's almost inequity because of the busing. It works.
I believe it was something like 88% of the people surveyed supported the efforts to ensure school diversity in the area.
So here, of course, I guess we look at the East End as sort of an area that's a very high concentration of poverty and of this public housing and lower income housing. And the trends have been that has started to continue out into the counties, right?
So the Civil Rights Project has been working on a report that outlines segregation trends in Virginia and then also in the major regions. And the really interesting thing that's happened in the Richmond area, two really interesting things. One is these really high levels of ongoing segregation by both race and poverty for Black students in the region. About 33% of Black students attend what the Civil Rights Project calls an intensely segregated school that's 90 to 100% non-white.
How does that compare to other regions?
It's much higher than Northern Virginia or the Norfolk,
so
Virginia Beach.
So 33% here, what would I see in Northern Virginia or Virginia Beach?
I think it's five times as high as what we see in Northern Virginia and twice as high. I think it's 18% in Norfolk, Virginia Beach. And that report's coming out the day of the conference, and the keynote speaker will be talking about it. But the other trend, in addition to the ongoing isolation of Black students, is that we, you know, have transitioned from a point in time where, I think in 1989, about 72% of segregation in the metropolitan area could be attributed to what was happening between different school districts, like between Richmond and Henrico and Richmond and Chesterfield. But today we've come to a situation where that's declined to where it's about evenly split. We see segregation between the districts, but we also see segregation within them. And your example of Henrico County illustrates that.
So, and that's what you're saying, is before you could almost cross the line and find, and in fact, there's a very, well, not popular, I guess it's a well-known book in the kind of circles that you guys travel in, I mm-hmm. guess. What is it? It's 5 miles away, a wall
yeah,
apart,
yeah, mm-hmm. that's right.
Written by a University of Virginia professor.
Right, James Ryan, who
James
is going to be at the conference.
He's coming.
I had a feeling.
Yeah, he is coming.
and James Ryan's book outlines that very stark separation between, mm-hmm. was it Godwin, I think, or is it
Freeman.
Douglas mm-hmm. Southall Freeman High mm-hmm. School in mm-hmm. the county, and then, of course, TJ in the city, Thomas
that's
Jefferson.
Right.
And again, Henrico almost, in fact, I talked with him briefly about that, how mm-hmm. you could save yourself the commute, that 5 miles, mm-hmm. you save some gas, and just done a story about Henrico High. And he agreed that, you know, there you're seeing those kinds of extremes. Henrico has really changed, though, I guess, in terms of its demographics, right, in the school system. It mm-hmm. used to be that it was a predominantly white school district, mm-hmm. and I think the last time I looked at any of the numbers, black-white populations are nearly equal, and then there's it's slightly skewed towards white population, and then that's kind of made up for by other minorities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's really become a very
multiracial,
mixed,
yeah.
And that must, I mean, that's got to change sort of, well, it's not just the complexion, but sort of how that district operates and who they're having to educate and where they're educating them, I suppose. And is that where we're running into these issues like Henrico High? Or I guess another example is Highland Springs seems to be a high concentration African-American and low-income mm-hmm. school mm-hmm. rather than being more equitably.
It's interesting that the latest census data, five-year estimates that came out in December, show some brand new high-density poverty tracts now in West End, where Regency Mall is located. It's multinational. And then there is a census tract that's high-density Latino that is the same place where the Henrico County Government Headquarters is located, just off Parham Road.
That's, what is that, the British flags flying across the street from the police station, I think, is that apartment complex
right.
that seems to have a very high concentration.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And a lot of people are completely unaware of really the extent to which poverty, as well as just nationalities and languages, are moving increasingly west into Henrico.
So, and this is, these are other minorities, essentially. These yes. are the ones you, the sort of happened without them ever noticing that it was happening, and all of a sudden they now have these new populations that are not necessarily your typical, prototypical West End family.
That's right.
So, Tom, as this conference unfolds, are we going to be talking about solutions to this, and what are...
We're going to solve it all. We're going to the conference.
Thank
so
goodness.
come and you'll hear all the solutions.
60 years, finally, they held this conference.
We're just academics. We just like to pose the big questions and let other people solve the problem. No, we're gonna talk about some issues. Actually, we're going to have a good wrap-up at the end where we're going to have audience participation and it will be directed, but it could also be organic. We're going to allow for a lot of conversation during each panel. Each panel is going to be fairly informal and in a way to generate conversation. We're going to be having a reception on Wednesday night and then again on Thursday night to allow people to have that conversation and to continue the dialogue. We are going to be setting up a Facebook account and then obviously all modern, technology.
All mod cons.
Twitter account to allow for tweeting during the conference and for posting ideas. And then also a listserv as well. We're going to be working on having a listserv afterwards too. One of the things we want out of this is to start a conversation and to start having a dialogue on this. And I think with the numbers that we're starting to see with people, that are registered for the conference, I think we're starting to see that there's an interest in a dialogue. And I think, one thing that's about the school divisions, if I can say, is that they work well together. The leadership works very well together. They know each other. They all four divisions talk a great deal, not just on snow days. They talk, a lot about it, a lot of different issues.
They did coordinate well this time, too.
Yeah, they coordinate pretty good yesterday. But they know these issues, right? I mean, I always like to say is, the first person that knows what's happening in a community usually is a teacher, because they know what's happening is when students come in through their schoolhouse door, and they've known this has been going on, right?
And that brings up another thing, I guess, is this is a kind of a tough, I felt sort of, I don't know, a little bit of a awkwardness talking about it with Kim, it's a difficult issue to say there are districts, there are problems with some of our districts, that there are these segregated lines, and that things aren't necessarily always equitable, but this strikes me as an effort at a particularly candid conversation. Jamel seems like a particularly inspired selection for somebody who's going to be a leader in the conversation. She's an African-American in a predominantly white school district that has done an incredible job of being an example of equitability in the Richmond metro area. But it is kind of an uncomfortable conversation to have, isn't it?
No, not necessarily. If you look at it in terms of, I think, how we're approaching the conference as an opportunity, as a positive here, what we want to discuss is why diversity is important. The nation, by most estimates, by 2040, 2043 will be a majority-minority nation. It's happening. Henrico now is a majority-minority in terms of student population. It's happening across the United States. So our diversity is just is a plus. It's a positive. One thing we didn't talk about in this, is this notion of poverty and what poverty, as John has documented in his Unpacking the Census, that's a whole different other conversation that is a component of this, right? And the impact of poverty on a young person when they go to school, and so we'll have some of that conversation, and that's a background to this. But we also want to consider that diversity is as a positive, and to talk about what that means. Because what we're facing, I think, as a country, and what we need to start working on is, as we become more diverse, we cannot isolate ourselves by any means, because the rest of the world will be continuing to move forward. Our world's becoming flatter, more globally oriented. Other countries are taking this diversity very serious, and this knowledge that it's become a very global society. And so we need, I think, as a region to say, let's work on this as a region. Let's see what the vision that marriage had 40 years ago. And let's stop, saying this or that to each other and really start putting it in place some things that can help us in a positive sense of experiencing that diversity. And I think that's really what the conference is trying to achieve here, is start that conversation on. So I don't
Is it fair to say, though, that our past experience, we have not seen our diversity as a positive?
Oh, yeah. I would definitely say that would be the case. And even to some extent now, I mean, I think we still have that. But we need to start having a conversation on it and to move it forward and have a dialogue on it, because it's so important to where we're going and so important to our students and what our students are going to be experiencing in the future.
I think it's just very interesting doing this around this 40th anniversary of that. Mm-hmm. That decision is just it's so important to Richmond. It redefined, or I guess it maybe solidified, the definition of Richmond metro area's education system for the 40 years since, really. Mm-hmm. Well, again, can you, I guess one of you want to go over the dates of when the conference is and how to register, etc.?
Oh, Lord, you're going to leave the details to me.
Let's hear it.
Let's see. March 13th at VCU in the Sports Parlor buildings right near the Siegel Center. All this information is at www.richmond.edu/movingforward.
Mm-hmm.
Good job.
Good job.
Thank you.
Well done.
So that's Wednesday evening from 5 to 8 p.m. on the VCU campus. That's the keynote speaker, Dr. Gary Orfield. And then the following day is an all-day conference. We have so many wonderful people who've really been leading the country when it comes to looking at diversity as an opportunity and to thinking about how to move forward. So all these people are coming to the University of Richmond campus, the Jepson Alumni Hall.
Center. Yeah. Jepson Alumni Center. We have a Jepson Hall, too.
Havoc doesn't live there, right?
Yeah, Havoc doesn't live there right now.
No. We're not talking about that right now.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It hurts. But this is open to the public?
Free and open to the public. But you do need to register. It's filling up quickly.
Okay.
And that the Thursday conference is from 8 to 6.
8 to 6. Registration starts at 7:15. We'll have coffee and some light refreshments there, and then it's lunch. We provide lunch.
And then heavy conversation, right?
And then heavy conversation, and then we end with the reception, too. So just don't come from the reception, though. Come for the day.
Come for the party at the end.
Just don't do that. Yeah, it's on a college campus, but this is a serious conversation.
All right, and I've been with Tom Shields. He's a professor of educational leadership at University of Richmond School of Professional and Continuing Studies. Kim Bridges, former Richmond School Board chairwoman, who's in Shields' program and who's helping to organize this very important and formative, hopefully, upcoming event. Jen Siegel-Hawley, she's assistant professor at VCU in the School of Educational Leadership. And, of course, John Meeser, the preeminent John Meeser, senior fellow at the Bonner Center for Civic Engagement, who's, frankly, the great granddaddy of all of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Thank you guys for being
Thanks,
here.
Chris.
Thank you so much.